You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
G'day listeners, it's Mick, your host. Welcome to The Dead Prussian podcast. In this episode, I'll be chatting with Phil about force structure versus force utility. But before we get to that, a quick thank yous. Thank yous out there go to The Strategy Bridge, Grounded Curiosity, and War on the Rocks. All three of these excellent websites, publications, and podcasts have been able to help us get out and reach a broader audience, and you've also been able to steer a few guests my way, which is quite good. In fact, it's where I first noticed Phil himself. I've also got some thanks to go out to the Murphy Raid and the Lowy Interpreter. They are two Australian blogs. Make sure you check them out. They are easily found on the web. Just Google the Murphy Raid and also Google the Lowy Interpreter. They're doing some work talking about digital diplomacy, and they managed to give a shout out to the website. So here is my reciprocal shout out to you guys. Thanks very much. I read you constantly, probably more than my boss at work wants me to, and thank you very much for the good work you're doing. And finally, for those listeners that have given us an iTunes review, thanks very much. We are now in the top 10 new and noteworthy of news and politics on the Australian iTunes. Strangely enough, most of our listeners tend to be in the US at the moment. That might be because of the commute time versus the time that each episode takes. I found that 30 minutes is a good commute, and Phil assures me that DC commutes are about 30 to 40 minutes, so we'll try and keep this one around the same time. So jump on iTunes, give us a review if you haven't. What it does is it helps us get out there to the listeners and engage with a broader audience. All right, that's enough of me yammering and thanking everyone with all the plugs out of the way. Today, as I said, I'm chatting with Phil Walter. Phil has served in the military, the intelligence community, and the interagency world. The views expressed by Phil during this are his own, and all the views by myself are always my own. We are going to be talking about force structure versus a force utility. If I can say there is a broad topic in the world, this is probably one of the broadest. We will be covering times from when Romans were required to do humanitarian aid right up until the way that we continue to structure forces for a Clausewitzian fight. Even though some of the fights we go to don't have any fighting in them at all. First, let's get to know Phil. G'day Phil, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Mick. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's a lovely Sunday afternoon here, so I know that I've got you up late on your Saturday evening, so we'll make this short, sharp, and informative for the readers.
No problem. It's not late at all. It's about 8:30 my time, so no issues.
Really, 8:30 on a Saturday night. Usually, I'm asleep in bed with a good book. Usually, that good book is On War by our friend Big Carl. All right, Phil, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? And I'm very interested to know what got you into writing. I note that you're a member of the Military Writers Guild. You've published on The Bridge and other websites. And I find it fascinating to read some of your work. So, a diverse background. Tell us, who is Phil?
Thank you very much for the compliment. So I've been fortunate enough to have served in the U.S. military, both active duty and reserves, both as an enlisted member and as an officer. I served in the intelligence community and did an interagency tour, and I've been deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Horn of Africa. And I got started in writing really as an outlet. There's a post that I wrote about why I joined the Military Writers Guild, where I kind of get into more detail. But when ISIL started to come to fruition, and everybody was, all the pundits and things were clamoring, you know, the U.S. should go back into Iraq, and everybody was saying, well, you know, we're going to destroy these people. We're going to destroy this. And I sat here thinking about all the blood and treasure that everybody's expended over the last 15 years trying to fight an idea. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, are we really going to, is the U.S. really going to go into the idea fighting business again? And I became really upset about it. And I said, I have to figure out a way, because I believe I have some thoughts that may be of value to someone somewhere. And so I need to start writing them down. And so I started a website and started a Twitter. And the first fellow writer I met was Ty Mayfield and John DeRosa. And they introduced me to Nate Finney. And next thing I know, I was sucked into this beautiful, amazing world that I occupy. And I'm a member of the Military Writers Guild. And that's just a great group of people. We all support each other and help each other and take care of each other. And it has been a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I'm glad that some of the things that I write are of value to folks, and I'm enjoying the chance to continue to write and appear on podcasts.
So a couple of those names from the Military Writers Guild are actually good friends of the show and helped us out with some advice, and also pointing us towards some great guests that we're going to be having in the future, some of whom I'll keep secret for now. You talk about the war of ideas, and of course, our topic today is going to be force structure, but much like the war on crime and the war on drugs, the war on terror isn't really a concept conceived of in On War by Clausewitz, that being the baseline for all of my thought. How do you fight against an idea, and how do you structure a force to fight against an idea?
Yeah, so it's interesting when you look at... let me go a bit broad and get more specific in that context. So I think that the first thing that's interesting is I think that we may be in the positions where we're fighting an idea because we have large conventional forces. One could say that because militaries have many, many divisions and many, many brigades, that is why the enemies choose to use, tactics that some may call, asymmetric or hybrid or terrorism, or, choose what moniker you want. But the reality of it is, to me, is that the history of a force that is small attacking a force that is big in a way that ensures the survivability of the smaller force is not a new concept. I think that smaller forces have always struck in ways that will ensure their survival. So that's not anything new. But to me, one of the friction points always goes back to the situation of what is the drivers of the folks who are radicalizing or terrorizing or violent extremists or what have you. And we're kind of in a spat today where probably not looking at the, division versus division fight as often as we are looking at the how do we change people's minds so they choose a way other than being a violent extremist. And I don't necessarily think that the military element, military instrument of power is the best tool for that. But unfortunately, a lot of times people default to the military because they think it's like a cure-all for whatever ails a country.
And I guess a military power, is one of the forces that the government has to use. I mean, we know that Clausewitz said that war is a continuation of politics or policy, depending on which translation you read. I don't know much German, so I've recently learned that my word for beer glass was wrong, so we're not going to go down into the difference between the interpretations. But war being a continuation of policy or politics by other means, a military force is a very powerful tool for a government to reinforce their political and diplomatic requirements. It's also one of the fastest methods that a government can use to articulate their desired end state of any particular situation. However, the flexibility may not be there. We even saw that, when Napoleon was coming up as a young general, he took some of the revisions done and he had to restructure his force to carry on conventional war, even against opponents that he could have fought a conventional war with the force he had, but he had to restructure to fight the way he wanted. So restructuring is not new for militaries, but perhaps the baseline fighting unit for militaries we've seen continues to devolve to the smaller element. And we see, battle battalion commanders, brigade commanders, probably responsible for areas that belong to corps and divisions. when we talk about a fighting force and how we structure for a fight, a lot of people these days talk about this, the interagency fight. Now, the interagency fight, do you consider that a new thing, or how, you know, is it just an extension of the old political methods that were used previously?
So in the, I mean, you know, you'll see a lot of the acronym DIME.
Yeah.
Diplomacy, and some say I is information or intelligence, you know, yeah. M is military and E is economic. But the friction point we have in the U.S. is that in our statutes and our laws, each executive branch agency that does the D and the I and the M and the E has their own authorities. And so while you may look at a traditional, you know, principle of war as unity of command, you know, that's actually been changed to an interagency standpoint to list to be as unity of effort, because yeah. I cannot take the, you know, executive agency branch agency in the U.S. and subordinate them to some other branch. I also can't cross the streams of funding between an aid organization and a military organization and a Department of Treasury and Department of State. We're not allowed to cross those. So the idea of using DIME is great, but at least in the U.S. we have certain statutory things that limits the effectiveness of that construct in execution.
Yeah, and that's part of, I suppose, any liberal democracy that aims for transparency. They've got to have checks and balances across departmental efforts, which makes it both transparent, and the people who are being governed are allowed to see where their money goes. But I guess also you can see where it has limits to the capability being deployed. So the unity of effort is probably something that has existed for a while. But what we're seeing throughout a long history of warfare is that a force is structured in a particular sense. I think we could probably both agree that forces previously and post Big Carl are kind of structured for that Clausewitzian idea of war, where, you know, if the political end is never met, you'll reach a point where you've got absolute war. But the flexibility with which that military force is being employed, humanitarian operations, from my knowledge, have been going on at least since Mount Vesuvius erupted and Tiberius sent the Roman army in to evacuate the citizens and get as many people out as possible. He didn't have Rome aid or any interagency elements there that could help him, but he still required the centurions, the legates, and all of the legionnaires who were trained purely for mauling the Gauls to go in there and act like good citizens and humanitarian aid workers. This isn't a dynamic we've seen change. So I'm interested to see, or hear, because you can't see someone else's thoughts, to hear your thoughts on how we man, train, and equip like a Clausewitz, fight, but execute, you know, the softer power side of things.
So I find this topic in generally very, very, very fascinating because, you know, as I said earlier, I think that if we man, train, and equip for the Clausewitzian fight, then that enables, that sets the conditions globally that makes it so a lot of the things that we face end up being, you know, these smaller scale contingency operations and things that we have to respond to. So I think from a deterrence standpoint, having the, you know, Clausewitzian force is a good thing. But then when you execute with that in a way that it was not primarily designed, that's kind of where you run in, where you, the friction points can occur. So specifically, if you end up and actually I interjected this exact theme into our most recent chapter of our Iran 2026 invasion fiction piece that I'm writing with Diane May and Nate Finney, where we're writing from a Marine colonel's point of view, and he says he laments the idea of having to have 18-year-old Marines be taught cultural competence. He said he'd rather train his folks, you know, to do high-order violence than have to hold them back by the belt during execution. And when I was being trained as a Marine infantry officer, that exact phrase was what we were taught. He said, I'd rather train you guys for high-order violence than have to hold you back, than train you to be an aid worker, and then suddenly someday when you're assaulting the trench line in North Korea or somewhere, you're just not prepared. But the friction points we see in execution is the holding folks back by the belt and the having to employ in ways where cultural competency is something that you need, where the ability to think about second and third order effects to tactical actions is of value. You know, while from one person's point of view, the mayor of village X may be corrupt, and we know he's corrupt, so we're going to do a really high profile takedown and handcuff him and haul him out of the big building that he works in. Well, then suddenly you've got a population in that town that may have liked your presence. Now it doesn't matter because they have now turned upon you. So you may take down one person, but to those folks in the village or wherever, they may have seen him as the person that provides them food and water and fuel and is a key to their existence. So it's hard because I think the Clausewitzian big war thing is very, very constructive, and we need that, and that helps ensure that we execute things that are a lot less than that. But at the same time, then we have a significant learning curve when we execute those activities that require the cultural sensitivity and knowledge base and historical base and other things.
And it kind of drives towards the leader at every building block, I suppose, military forces made up with. Their educational piece can slowly, it can quickly become quite massive in terms of what they need to do. They need to be able to hold their troopers back in a culturally sensitive area, but they also need to be able to command the respect of their men and understand men and women. They need to be able to understand how to employ their team in both a violent, hard power kind of way, but also a very soft power way. The mental acuity and flexibility that's required for that is particularly among military leaders, and I'm not talking about just your troop commander, your lieutenant or lieutenant for American parlance. I'm talking going right up to your brigade commanders, your divisional commanders. I'm sure that as we see this, it's that flexibility to be able to, I guess it applies to everyday life. You plan for the worst, but you kind of expect something a little less than the worst. And that problem is, I don't have a zombie apocalypse kit in my garage. I don't. I'm not expecting it. But, when the zombies come, am I going to engage with them and discuss their need for brains? Or am I going to go on a Rick from Walking Dead rampage? It's probably a clumsy metaphor I'm using here, but when you think about it, there's a great demand in education there. So possibly, when we talk about force structure versus force utility, maybe it's force education and giving that experiential loop on how, there's been, 15 years of conflict involving conventional asymmetric fights in the Middle East. Lots of nations around the world have been involved in both the Central Asian and Middle Eastern conflicts. There's a lot of experiential knowledge on that particular fight there. And then what we see in Eastern Europe right now, that's getting closer to the conventional fight, but being called more of a hybrid fight. I think it's a great point that you make, that we've got an 18-year-old infantry battalion soldier here, and what do we spend most of our time in? Teaching him to be culturally sensitive for an area where he may deploy to, or do we give him the general skills to make him useful as an infantier? I don't know. What is the right mix? Have you got an idea what the right mix is?
Well, see, it's interesting, because if you look at the idea of a pre-deployment training cycle, You know, you have a limited amount of time. So what are you going to spend it on? You know, do you really want to drop range time in favor of learning whether they should eat with one hand or the other, or learning the greeting of the day? Or do you want to, you know, do you want to drop some time learning how to use communications equipment or battle drills in order to achieve, you know, talking about the second and third order effects of this or that or the other? If you, you know, take down the village chief, what's going to happen next? So I think the kind of larger, you know, let me go a bit higher level a bit, then I'll come back. I think the higher level part is that I would prefer that the policy decisions that are made for the military employ them in accordance with their capability. I think that's kind of the largest thing. You know, employer unit in accordance with its capability is one of the Marine Corps leadership principles, and I think that you know needs to be done in general. If I'm a politician somewhere and I'm looking across the D and the I and the M and the E, I don't necessarily want to use the M for a task that's good for the D. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes I would say we have a lowercase D, a lowercase I, a capital M, and a small E. And personally hoping that, you know, M gets lowercase and everything else gets uppercased here, you know, sometime before I die.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah, well, soft power is a much more gentle way for the rest of the world as well. I think, you know, if I was a nation state that was offered some economic benefits to go along with someone's political mindset, I probably would find that more alluring than, you know, being offered an invading force. But it's not always the way it plays out, I guess.
No, agreed. And so if we track back to like what is the right, you know, mix of, you know, obviously I would hate to say it depends, but, you know, it does. If you're going, I think a lot of it depends on kind of the historical portion of the culture in which you're about to enter. That's a big, big deal. I mean, for those of us who've done, you know, I was able to do Iraq and Afghanistan actually in the same year, which was a very interesting experience because I went from northern Iraq to southern Afghanistan within about 3 months, and it was totally a different world. And, you know, went from dealing with Kurds to dealing with hardcore Pashtun down in Regional Command South. So the I think, for example, for Afghanistan, one would need more cultural competency in Afghanistan. And, you know, based upon my experience there, it meant a lot more to do the things that were culturally correct than it did in Iraq. In Iraq, there was kind of the hand wave of, ah, he's an American, that's just the way he is. But in Afghanistan, it went a long way. So I think, you know, researching the same way a military unit would want to understand how their weapon systems will be affected based upon where they deploy. You know, if I'm going someplace cold, I need LSA or something instead of CLP to lube my weapon systems. You know, you're going to have to do kind of a similar assessment. When I get where I'm going, you know, what is the impact of not having that cultural knowledge before I go in? And, you know, the training of people is going to depend. Obviously, I'm going to train my, you know, privates probably need to know a bit, my corporals a little bit more, my sergeants a little bit more, my lieutenants a little bit more. And then as you go up the chain, it'll probably peak at a battalion commander. And then, you know, probably go back down because I don't know how many generals are going to be, you know, hanging out with the local population, or if they are hanging out with a portion of the population, it may be their peer who's a, you know, general in the host country army, and they may have been to some training or been outside the country before. So, you know, I think it's going to ebb and flow what you need, and it's going to vary upon rank, and it's going to, and the amount of training spent before the deployment is going to depend on the intensity of how the population is going to react to cultural knowledge or lack thereof.
So for the listeners who may or may not have missed that, we have just summarized the levers of national power in foreign policy right down to troop training programs. That's a level of knowledge with which Phil has. So if you're going cross-eyed, don't worry, you're not alone. I'm a little bit like this as well. But yeah, I totally think that you've hit the military nail on the head there. the level of training required across the spectrums of conflict, I'll call them spectrums of conflict, are is different, but it's that balance you've got to achieve. And you know, you mentioned pre-deployment training, which is a great concept, but if you don't know where you're going next, it makes it a little bit harder to prepare your force. Where I'd like to go next in our discussion, Phil, is recently you talked about an enduring framework. And in it, you mention a document called, what is it? Let me have a look. NSC 68.
Yes, one of my absolute favorite documents. It is a brilliant piece of writing. It will take you a long time to read because it's very small type and it's single spaced. But yeah, believe me, you will destroy a highlighter reading it because it's brilliant.
Yeah, I've got a copy of I don't know if it's the whole thing on here or not, but it seems like a very interesting paper that it is. For those people who haven't seen it, I encourage you to get along and find it. It is NSC-68. You'll be able to find it. I've got the website for it, but if you just read some of Phil's recent work, you'll see he's mentioned it, and there's a link to it. It is dated, and it refers to the Soviet Union, and it's a Cold War type document. But much like some elements of On War, where Clausewitz discusses the baggage train and things like that, there's a little bit of mental flexibility, and you can see that there's some enduring principles and concepts in there that turn out to be relevant. What is your favorite part about this? I mean, I look at things, I see the political, economic, and psychological warfare with which the USSR is waging. That is an interesting term, political, economic, and psychological. That's almost what we're trying to say in dime. Really, it's dime in a different form. And it would be called PEP. PEP's quite easier to say. It sounds kind of cool, PEP. listeners are probably going to hate that because I don't have my popper in front of my microphone at the moment. Okay, so what do you love about this document?
The thing I like about it the most is it really, at the end of the day, it really speaks to the then USSR as an ideology.
Yeah.
And something that could not be defeated militarily without significant cost. So it kind of outlines the whole containment idea. The really interesting parts about it and the phrase that is used in it, and I think also in its precursor document, NSC 20/4, is the phrase short of war.
Yeah, yeah.
Or we will use methods short of war.
Yeah.
And I love that because there's so much that can be done short of war. And I think unfortunately we all across the dime, people end up in their stovepipe of excellence, where they're only able to think in the stovepipe of D or I or M or E. Mm-hmm. And NSC 68 really pulled it all together, and it pulled it all together several years ago. And it's a great document. George Kennan, who I love to read everything he wrote, who had some significant impact on NSC 68. Mm-hmm. Has some great quotes about how, one of the friction points in the U.S. is we think there is a large difference between peace and war. And he said, peace is considered this and war is kind of like almost a sporting event. And he said, look, his point of view, I'll paraphrase, was that, look, it's all the same. This is, great power competition. Between at the time the U.S. and the USSR, but now at the end of the day, if you take a step back, a lot of things are competitions in general. In Iraq right now, we have a competition between ISIL and Iraq for who's going to own certain swaths of space. And so just the whole NSC 68 document. When I first discovered it, I felt like it's definitely one of those things where I was like, where have you been all my life? Because this is an amazing document. I just think it's great.
Yeah, I think, I'm just having flicked through it. I didn't bring my highlighter with it, but my wife gets upset when I use my highlighter on the screen.
Let me add one other point in it that I think is neat is way in the back, it speaks to kind of the role of the military, and they viewed it in a USSR context of, you know, pretty much the role of the active duty military forces was to hold on until the whole entire country could be mobilized for a fight against the USSR. And so they use this phrase about a tremendous force is basically what they envisioned as the fully mobilized United States. So the whole idea of the tremendous force, I think, is really, really interesting.
Yeah, I think that kind of speaks to, you know, where we see Big Carl coming out, his writings against, you know, the levy en masse and total war. And, he certainly wrote about limited wars, which is kind of, we kind of find ourselves in an age of limited wars at the moment, I think. And we also have national efforts that use military forces that aren't, you know, that they are, I suppose we could say, short of war. But yeah, this document, it's very interesting how, you know, it says things like, you know, make sure that you keep your own population aware, informed about the threats, the actions, and you know what the reality is. One thing that you see in this document is it's, and we're probably starting to see it now, is there's also an element of concern when this document's written. You know, it is not written under the assumption that they may not go to war. It's gear everything short of war because, you know what, we're not convinced that war's not going to happen.
Yeah, the interesting part, one of the parts I like about it as well is how they talk about if there is, and I actually, absolutely plagiarized this language because I was so inspired by it for my Enduring Framework piece that I wrote, where they spoke about if there is a way to negotiate with the Soviets and if they withdraw in some formal fashion, like allow them to do so with a minimum loss of face in the international community. And I think that's great. I really like the idea of, you know, just because a country has a victory over another in an activity that is short of war, it doesn't mean you should, you know, dance up and down and make a spectacle of yourself and celebrate it. So, you know, and I think about that often when I look at Ukraine and Putin and NATO expansion following the dissolution of the Soviet Union. I wonder if anyone thought whether, you know, was expanding NATO after the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, obviously by then NSC 68 had been written and rewritten about 20 times or so, and the world had changed. But it didn't really sit well with me as far as, you know, let's let somebody retreat while, you know, saving face in the international community. It's like, no, let's expand the very thing that they're most scared of.
Yeah, I think the idea of the magnanimous victor can sometimes be lost when engaging in war. And I guess an interesting point, we're talking about force structure, utility, cultural sensitivity, training your soldiers. You've brought up the point about how you need to understand your war aims, your war gains. Once the objective has been done, then, you know, especially now that a democratic nation needs to assist others in their own vision for democracy and the transparent liberal societies. And I say liberal with a lowercase L before anyone caught up in the American elections at the moment decides to jump on, give me a bad review. And anyone who's about to be caught up in the Australian election, it's a lowercase liberal, as in liberalism. What we see here is, you know, I hark back to the Peninsula Wars. You know, you had Napoleon go in to Spain. They didn't understand their cultural sensitivities with the force there under his brother. They didn't understand how they were being received. They were trying to deliver a civil code that, you know, a lot of our societies now benefit from the Napoleonic Code. They were trying to establish, you know, broader education for the citizens, more freedom of property ownership, freedom of social mobility. He used a military force to do that. There was structure to fight a conventional war, found himself up against the guerrillas, and that's guerrillas with a GU, not a GO. And you know, what he had essentially there was a failure to achieve his goals in the D, I, and E space because the M was so strong. And also, you know, you don't invade a country, defeat it, and then put your brother on the crown as a way to show them you want to lead them towards a brighter future. So, you know, that magnanimity in victory, you know, you've got to learn how far to exploit your victory and what spoils, I suppose, and I'll use the term spoils as a concept, what spoils to let slip by the wayside as well, because, it's an interesting point you make, you know. Do you continue on with the same course of action after you've won?
Exactly. And you know, at the same time, when you look at that, what's interesting to me is psychologically, when you look at an enemy, you know, even from a point of view of a large fight, you know, okay, so you win, but you don't want to win the war to such an extent that you cannot benefit from the peace. And so, yeah, you want to win, but you don't want to turn the entire society permanently against you, you know, even if there is a fight like that. So it's interesting, just like you said, you know, how far is far enough?
Yeah, the political objective, as Big Carl said, you've got to keep the political objective in mind, and you've got to understand that objective is political in nature. Look, we've probably got our commuters getting a little bit nervous as they're parking their car, getting ready to grab their ticket. It's been a great chat, Phil, but I've got a final question for you that everyone who comes on the show gets to finish a sentence for me, not because I'm incapable of finishing my own sentences, but because I find it a very interesting question, and it's probably one that's debated the most. And Klaus, it's realistically started the debate in full force. I will start the sentence, and I'll ask you to finish it. You've been engaged on this topic on Twitter, so I'm expecting a decent reply. Can you finish the sentence, war is?
Okay, I will start by saying the exact same thing I put on Twitter. So war is a national effort affecting the whole society, waging it, that seeks to change enemy behavior through violence. Now, I will expand a little bit on the word affecting. So to me, the term affecting means a declaration of war by the political leadership, the raising of taxes, you know, probably conscription or a draft, depending on what you call it, and rationing. So to me, war is something that affects everyone, and it is literally inescapable. If you're a member of that society, you are affected by it somehow. So in that context, I think it's smart to prepare for war, because I think if you prepare for war, what you will actually have to execute will be something significantly less than war.
That is a well thought out, well structured, probably more than 140 characters definition of a war. I thank you for that contribution. I would love to get into it and talk more, but we're going to run out of time. I want people to, I would like people listening who do have a copy of Big Carl's book to listen to Phil's definition again and then go read Big Carl and see what he says about absolute versus limited war, because I think what you'll find there is a very nice synopsis we've just been given by Phil on the concept that war will never reach its purest end, which is the fighting for fighting's sake, but it will reach a limited war in some smaller political objective that needs to be required. The idea of a war affecting a society, please go back and listen to episode 6 about our psychological history when it comes to military psychology and the way that nervous-related disorders were covered off in World War One. It's a great understanding of how the costs of war and the effects of war actually affect a society that may or may not understand how far that war is actually affecting them at the time. Look, Phil, it's been great having you on the show. I'm probably going to ask you to jump on again at some point in the future. One, because it's been a great chat, and two, I don't think I've gotten inside your mind enough yet. And having read a lot of your work on the internet, you have a lot of fascinating opinions and information on this whole national security sphere. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Mick. I'm glad to be of use.
Well, it's glad to have someone that's useful. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to the show. For those that haven't seen the improvements to our website, thedeadprussian.com has improved our website. We now have episodes listed. You can play the latest episode or you can download any of the previous episodes. We've changed the About page. We've also increased the way that you can contact us through the website. And there is more coming. Rumor of a war college with a list of references for books, websites, and podcasts is true. I'm currently working on that, but it's having me do a little bit more computer code than I was designed for myself. Go to iTunes, leave us a review, listen to the show, tell your friends. Thanks, everyone. And visit Phil Walter, 1058. .com, and you'll be able to benefit from all the good reading that I have benefited from over the past 3 to 4 months. Until then, crack a book.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian Page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian Podcast is written, produced, and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.